Let me do one book recommendation.
Yes.
This is a great book recommendation, and it's not even one that I've written, so you can tell I'm being impartial here. Let me recommend to you this book, The Universe Upstairs. Now, it's a little bit old. It's from the 1980s. But that means it has the advantage that when you go onto Amazon, you can pick these up for a couple of quid. Mm. Okay. It is based on a book called The Universe Next Door by James W. Sayer, which is a book about worldviews, which is in its like fifth edition now. It's like the famous Christian text about different worldviews. But this book, The Universe Upstairs, by Merv James, published by Frameworks, by it's an imprint of IVP from 1991. A cartoon guide to worldviews is a cartoon book version of the first edition of the Universe Next Doors, and it goes through Christian theism, deism, naturalism, nihilism, existentialism, pantheistic monism, the New Age movement, in cartoon strip form, explaining about those different worldviews. So this is really accessible and fun and cheap.
I can only find it on Amazon, used from £17.82. If you can find a link and send it to me, I'll send it out.
I will try. Maybe they're getting so rare now that they're going up. If so, you'll probably find it cheaper to buy The Universe Next Door, but that's a bit more of a slog than this. I'm sure you must be able to find second-hand copies of this around. And I've got a couple, so I'll happily lend one out anyway. You can just pass it around the group. So, yeah. Okay. Let's see how we do.
Jones is sitting at home.
Yeah. With timing. We started a little late, so we may finish a little late, we'll see. I've introduced, I don't need to reintroduce this concept of spirituality. We're going to apply this concept of spirituality, the head, hearts, hands combination, your assumptions, attitudes, actions. Okay, some long words, but then we'll mainly get into cultural examples and what we feel about things. Two fundamental elements of a worldview, the long philosophical words are ontology and epistemology. Ontology deals with questions about what's real, what sort of things exist, okay? And epistemology is questions about knowledge. How do we know about what sort of things exist? So here is my concrete kind of example. So coffee is among the things that sort of things that exist. Because coffee exists, yeah? We're drinking some at the moment. We know that coffee exists. How do we do that? Through this sort of introspection of our physical senses. You are currently drinking, smelling, tasting, feeling the heat, etc., of coffee. So you're using what we call our physical senses, but notice you're having these mental experiences of these physical senses. And if I also put down the statement, your pleasure in drinking coffee is a thing that exists, okay? And that you just know, you don't know that by any of your physical senses, do you? How do you know that? Through introspecting your mental kind of feeling about coffee. So you might say that the kind of physical things, people with a naturalist, materialist worldview are going to be very comfortable with. Perhaps it's a little harder when talking about pleasure, coffee. You can see there are going to be different worldviews are going to be sort of happy with different lists of things that exist and different ways of knowing that things exist. And also a point about, we talked earlier about spirituality aiming to be integrative, and therefore there's a possibility of it being the opposite. So spiritual integration is about this combination of your assumptions and attitudes and actions. When you internalize them, you're not just going along with it for the sake of it. You're actually committed to it from the inside out, as it were. You're internalizing this combination, and it leads to a virtuous integration of your personhood. It leads you to greater wholeness. But there's also the possibility that there's such a thing as spiritual disintegration, where the more you commit to a particular spirituality, the more that internalization leads to a spiritual disintegration of your personhood, where those different elements start pulling against each other, and you feel sort of pulled apart as a person by your spirituality rather than put together by them. So a very famous quote from St. Augustine's Confessions here. He said, "My sin was this, that I looked for pleasure and beauty and truth, not in him, not in God, but in myself and his other creatures, and the search led me instead to pain and confusion and error." It was like trying to get the wholeness and the fullness that we're designed for in relationship with God. It was trying to get those things out of things that weren't God. He was, spiritually speaking, trying to get blood from a stone, he thought. And so trying to fulfill and bring integration and fulfillment to a person by excluding God and focusing on the things that God has made to bring you those fulfillments, Augustine, as a Christian, came to think that was a fundamental mistake in life. And he's sort of really saying, if you have a spirituality that excludes God, it's going to lead you to disintegration. And you can also mention here that spiritualities are, of course, not just an individualistic thing, but they are a corporate thing. We share a spirituality, so we all commune in Christ together. We have something in common. We have a common spirituality, and that can apply to culture, society. A culture is sort of the artistic product of a shared spirituality, if you like. And so culture reflects spirituality, including worldview, and can reflect that either integrating or disintegrating nature of spirituality. Just think about all the discussions in news programs this last week about the role of social media in causing disintegration in society in various ways, for example. Yeah, although, you know, we've just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the internet and how it was intended to kind of bring unity, bring sharing of information and bring people together, and yet is being used, of course, by people to separate, you know, us from them, and to champion white nationalism or whatever. So you will know from Snow White, the mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all question. This is a key kind of way of looking at worldviews. Worldviews, they reflect our self-image, if you like. Once upon a time, we looked into what I'm going to call the pre-modern Christian worldview. And we asked this question, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? And the pre-modern Christian mirror is going to say something along these lines. It's going to say, well, God is the fairest of them all. He's the maximally beautiful being who created the cosmos and made humanity in his image, only a little lower than the angels. It's kind of, that's the sort of starting foundation point. This is like Genesis 1 for the Christian story. And in cultural terms, let me give you an example of a architecture informed by a Christian worldview. So here's Salisbury Cathedral, well worth visiting if you haven't, particularly after today, because we'll have these things in mind as well. Europe's tallest spire. It's huge, it's massively monumental and imposing, and considering that they built this with like their bare hands and some rope and some wood and a few chisels back in the medieval period, over hundreds of years of effort to the glory of God, quite something. It's a Gothic cathedral. David Levin, Gothic cathedrals are some of the crowning achievements of Western architecture. Every archway, every decoration has a meaning and a purpose. It is a building suffused with a sense of meaningfulness, of having a purpose. So this is the relatively new font that they've installed in the cathedral. It's in the sort of cross cruciform shape. And the water is constantly flowing. So out of the four corners of the font, water is always pouring out into the grill around it, like a fountain. And so the font is sort of speaking artistically about the cross, baptism into the cross, into the water of life. You know, Jesus talking to the woman at the well about, you'd ask me for the water of life and it would become, bubbling up the waters of life within you, and so on. It's talking about all sorts of biblical themes, using that biblical imagery in, it's a work of craft, but also one might argue a work of art as well. It's suffused with meaning. And the water, though it's flowing, is very still on the top, and the whole thing kind of acts as a mirror in which you can see the fluted roof of the cathedral without straining your neck, which is very good for me at the moment. The choir stalls, the investment in IT technology appropriate to the age. They had stereophonic sound. The choir stalls are facing each other because you're using music that makes a distinction between the left side of the choir singing and the right side of the choir singing, because they've got stereophonic sound. Indeed, they would often put little groups of singers in the roof, in the rafters. It's like 5.1 surround sound when you think about it, medieval music. The original universities were religious institutions. This is why Oxford and Cambridge, Notre Dame, Christ Church College, Jesus College, Trinity College, they're religious institutions, where we get the foundation of the university system from. Vishal Mangalwadi, who's an Indian philosopher, who seemed to have an Asian perspective on this, says that the scientific perspective flowered in Europe as an outworking of the medieval biblical theology nurtured by the church and the Bible. These things created and underpinned the scientific outlook. Basically, to break that down with this charming medieval painting of Adam and Eve, if God, the rational creator, created the world out there and created humanity in his image, the way we think in here about stuff and the way things out there work should both reflect God. So we should be able to understand something about God, not comprehend God. He's bigger than us. But we should, it's not surprising that we understand something of God, because we can relate to him. We're built for that relationship, and relationships involve thinking, as we said earlier. And that we can also understand the world created by God. We expect the world to exhibit faithful, rational patterns, for example, because they're made by a God who is faithful, a God of covenant, and so on. And all these kind of expectations underpinned the fact that science flourished in medieval Europe, and that's where it came from. And it's, you know, it's not, as historians of ideas and so on, it's not at all that, you know, Asian people are less intelligent than Western people or so on. But why did science start in medieval Europe, not in China? They had technology, they had some very clever technology that we didn't have. You know, invented gunpowder before we did, and water clocks and ways of measuring earthquakes and things, but they didn't get involved in the systematic scientific investigation through experimentation and observation and so on of the world. And that's because they had a different worldview. Alvin Plantinga says, modern science arose within the bosom of Christian theism. Example of the powers of reason which God's created us with, a display of the image of God in human beings. Christians are committed to taking science with the utmost seriousness, and so on. This is the cloisters of Salisbury, and you can see this kind of commitment to science again in Salisbury. For example, they've got the claimed to be the oldest working clock in the world, from 1386, round about then, is at Salisbury Cathedral.
Wasn't that the cathedral the Russians always claimed to
visit it? Yes. Yeah, that's right. We'll the famous... We were scumbag. We were visiting the clock.
Yeah. I
don't remember
the
clock, so
I
didn't
do that.
Yeah.
The
well-famous
clock.
But it's like... Yeah. So, there is this sort of, you know, religion and science and art and the architecture. It's all coming from the world view. That's holding these things together in a unity. And to give a more modern example, I've paired here. I'm going to inflict some prog rock on you, but not for long. On the right, we have a painting by the Japanese Christian artist, modern artist Makoto Fujimura, and this piece is called Grace Foretold. And it's obviously, it's not, like, often we think of religious art and you think, oh, picture of the Virgin Mary and her little baby, and kind of, this is more abstract than that, but it's, that doesn't mean it's not Christian art. Okay? It doesn't have to be programmatic. I've paired it with these lyrics, and I'll play the music as well, from this song from the Christian prog group Iona, or a sort of Celtic rock band. From their album and the track An Atmosphere of Miracles, which I think really sums up a kind of Christian worldview, and sort of living in this sense of we're saved but we're not saved yet, we're living in this world in light of eternity but dealing with the slog of living in this world kind of now thing. And really as I was saying earlier, beauty is objective, and this is an objectively beautiful piece of music, but you may not be attuned to it, because our receptivity to beauty is subjective. This is a key distinction. But let me just play this to you, because I do think if you do connect with it, the music actually helps communicate the message, and I think it resonates very nicely with the painting. And let me just play this music and just let you sort of meditate upon not just the words and the imagery and the feelings of the music and what it feels like to be living life inside of a Christian worldview, because this will then contrast nicely with what we go on to later. So I apologise if you don't like prog. Let's reinstigate your have a chat with someone else manoeuvre. And then we'll do some group feedback.
Someone different?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I just love these when we see beyond what appears to have died, when all is restored as it should be, as it should, in an atmosphere of miracles, when courage rises up and the power of fear is defeated in love, a love that will heal, a love that will restore, like water to the desert, like a key to the door that opens to freedom, that opens to life, seeing what can become when faith is alive. So this again, this sense of this longing for what will be, what's promised, but also a recognition that we don't have it yet. What can become, that will open up, that will be opened up, kind of. But in the meantime, also this reassurance that our King is here with us, that God's not remote from us. He came into, broke into our darkness, and so on. So, that kind of balance of, yeah, love it. Anyway, so we had this Christian culture which assumed a cosmos, an ordered beauty. The word means it's Cosmopolitan magazine. A cosmos of material and immaterial realities created by a transcendent creator God. It's what exists, ontology. Culture assumed that people made in God's image could have knowledge by various means of both God and the cosmos. That's what we know. And culture assumed and pointed to these objective transcendent values, knowable values of truth and goodness and beauty that cut across all of the different departments in the university. And that sense of the university coming out of the cathedral, the religious institutions, the unifying theology as the queen of the sciences and so on, back in the day when science just meant knowledge. Yeah. And then one day culture turned its back on God and looked into the modernist worldview mirror, as I'm going to call it, and asked this question: who is the fairest of them all? And you know the answer, that goes something like this. The modernist mirror says, according to science, which is the only way to know anything, man is the fairest of them all. Although an unverifiable value term like fair is merely an expression of emotion. The most rational being to have arisen via the blind watchmaker of neo-Darwinian evolution, a child of Mother Nature, who will soon come of age and reject the childish superstitions of religion. Okay, so this is the read Richard Dawkins or Peter Atkins or whatever. So we have a sort of naturalistic, materialistic view of what things exist. Reality as a whole is basically an uncreated, purposeless, valueless, closed, non-intentional, perhaps merely physical system of things. So, for example, the atheist Alex Rosenberg says, physics is causally closed and causally complete. Once you've told the physics story about something, you've told the whole story about it that's real, that's true. And we can start perhaps pushing on questions like, well, does reality really fit inside that limiting box of reality according to materialism or reality according to naturalism or whatever? We can start going down our list of, well, coffee exists, but what about my enjoyment of coffee? What about saying this is a beautiful cup of coffee? Does that fit? And what do you do if not? Which way do you... what do you do to resolve that tension? Plantinga again, a naturalist will be an atheist, but not every atheist is a naturalist. Naturalism is stronger than atheism, so, these things kind of nest inside one another. Atheism, basically the belief that there isn't God. Some try and redefine it as, I just don't believe in a God. But that makes it hard to distinguish atheism from agnosticism, which is not knowing whether or not there's a God. And indeed, if atheism is just lacking a belief in God, then, tortoises are all atheists, for example.
So the difference between atheism and agnosticism is that they just don't know.
So
atheism
is
like, there's definitely no God.
Yeah, so there's an answer to this question. We think we know the answer, and the answer's no, there isn't a God. We may be more or less sure about that, but yeah, we're saying to the question, is there a God? We're saying the answer is no, but I'm an atheist. If you're saying to the question, is there a God? We're saying, don't know. Agnostic.
So would most agnostics be open to it?
Yeah, so that would imply, so some agnostics, some people distinguish between hard and soft agnosticism, so some agnostics say we can't know the answer to the question if there are a God or not. Mm-hmm. Whereas some just say, well, we don't know. And that therefore implies being more open to, well, maybe I could be convinced. Maybe I just haven't come across the clinching argument or haven't had the right experience or whatever. Whereas the hard agnostic is going to say, no, we can't know. We're just too, you know, I don't know, they're going to say something like, you can only know things through science and you could never know the answer to that question through science, therefore we could never know. Mm. Which comes on to scientism, you know, this particular answer to how we know stuff that says only through scientific empirical kind of methods. Rosenberg in Atheist Guide to Reality, and he claims this term for himself and says being scientistic just means treating science as our exclusive guide to reality. We trust science as the only way to acquire knowledge. Did anyone go to the discussion between Peter Atkins and John Lennox at Southampton Uni? Yeah, seen the video of it. He's very scientistic. He says, I stand by my claim that scientific method is the only means for discovering the nature of reality. So on.
What did you think of it? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Nothing surprising in as much as I knew the positions of the two guys beforehand. But it
what
was
about
a,
how they conveyed their argument?
Yeah, I was quite... Peter Atkins, as was often the case, didn't do himself many favours on the ethos front.
Yeah.
Whereas John Lennox tends to be more charming.
Yeah.
Whilst not foregoing his rational onus either. Dawkins has the same kind of views. Lots of people in this sort of your generation, recent generations, have picked up this sort of scientistic overcommitment to science as how we know things. And they can find that very limiting in terms of engaging with religious issues sometimes. Proper evidence-based belief and so on. The only good reason to believe something exists is if there's real evidence that it does. Whereas on the other hand, there's blind faith, as if the blind is sort of a redundant qualifier. Faith means blind faith, just believing something without any evidence and so on. Well, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, look it up in a dictionary. This scientific demand, you could think of it as a sort of claim that every rational belief must be justified by empirical evidence to qualify as being rational. But that statement itself, it just contradicts itself. It doesn't meet its own standard, because the demand that every rational belief must be justified by empirical evidence can't be justified by empirical evidence. Another way to think of it is that demand entails an infinite regress. I should only believe A if I've got empirical evidence for it. Call that empirical evidence B. But why do I believe B? And why do I believe that B really supports belief in A? Well, in order for those beliefs to be rational, I've got to have empirical evidence for them. You see, what you end up, you get a multiplication of this demand for evidence that just multiplies and gets, you know, worse and worse in a sense. You can't fulfill it. It's also just, you know, open to obvious counter examples, like knowing that you like coffee. logical or moral knowledge, you know, I think I know that it's wrong to shoot people at prayer just because they're Muslims. What empirical evidence do I have for that? What empirical evidence could I have for that? I think, you know, you need logic in order to do science, but what empirical evidence can you have for truth claims that apply not only to the way things happen to be in this world, but are meant to apply to all logically possible worlds? How can you can't infer from empirical evidence using scientific method to necessary truth claims? So on. Okay. Scientism is just too narrow. It might allow in coffee exists, but moving down this list to this is a beautiful cup of coffee and so on might be a bit tricky. And that's why you end up with, in many people's mind, as Nancy Piercy points out, lovely book, Saving Leonardo, lots of stuff about culture and worldviews. This strict separation of facts from values is really big in Western culture. But then this is kind of where it comes from. And she says, people have always known there's a distinction between is and ought, between descriptive and normative statements. But in earlier ages, people thought that both types of statements dealt with questions of truth. It was, you know, it's true to say this is the way that things are or that they work, and it's true to say that this is the way that you should behave. Whereas the sort of scientism view says, well, you can have a description of how people tend to behave, but when you start saying, you know, you ought to do this, well, that's not the sort of truth claim that you could have empirical evidence for, therefore it's just subjective and meaningless, and you get this sort of distinction of there are the facts that are scientifically knowable, and there's all that mumbo jumbo touchy feely stuff, which we'll leave to the humanities, that's about values, but that's not about stuff that you can know or argue about or so on. And this all comes back to this sort of narrow view of knowing the world, which I think is fundamentally misplaced and is certainly non-biblical. So Alex Rosenberg, again, really useful insight into the sort of thoroughgoing atheist worldview. His book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, here's his little sort of summary of his creed. Is there a God? No. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when we die? Well, everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. What is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Okay. But the key point I want to kind of make is that there is a connection between having those assumptions about what is real and how we know what's real, and what's going to go on in your, if you try and live consistently with that, what's going to go on in your heart and in your behaviour and in your culture and so on. He goes and he says, individual human life is meaningless, without purpose, without ultimate moral value. We need to face the fact that nihilism, the denial of all value, is true. Because creating purpose in a world that can't have any is like trying to build a perpetual motion machine after you've discovered that nature's ruled them out. If this seems hard to take, there's always Prozac. It's not just a throwaway thought. He comes back at the end of the book and he says, what should we scientific folk do when overcome by, and he uses the German word here, Weltschmerz, but world weariness? What if this view of reality makes us depressed? This is take two of whatever neuropharmacology prescribes. There's his, pull your socks up and take some drugs. That's his solution. But maybe, you know, if you're really convinced that this is true, and you're committed to the value of living according to the truth and the value of being consistent. And hang on a minute. What's the distinction between good and bad? Again, is it bad for me to not live consistently with what I think's true? If I think this is true? He starts getting into all sorts of knotty kind of issues here, but he's really trying to push, like, deal with it, dude. And yet, on his own view of things, why be so committed to being like that? To facing up to reality, growing up, and all of these kind of, you know, enlightenment sort of images of humanity growing up and coming of age and so on. And then we have the new atheists, particularly because of their emphasis on it's either blind faith in irrationality or science. They're against not just belief in God, but respect for belief in God. Religion's not only wrong, it's evil, as Gary Wolfe put it in Wired magazine. So if you add materialism and scientism together and bolt that to a sort of moral crusade against religious faith because it's evil, because it's really bad for people not to live up to their moral responsibilities to try and be reasonable, even though people don't have any free will, and therefore can't really have any moral responsibility, and there's no such thing as a difference between good and evil, according to most of them, and like, they get into all these self-contradictions. Back to architecture. So, classic French architecture here from Le Corbusier, The Crow, 20th century French guy, famously called houses machines to live in. Well, if you have this sort of materialistic, scientistic worldview, everything basically is machinery, in a sense. You know, the physical description is all the truth about everything, like Rosenberg says. So are people just sort of machines? And houses are machines for machines to live in. Like, the most efficient way of organising our machines is to put them in little boxes. And yet, there's a nice bit of colour on the boxes to give us a little sense of aesthetic beauty, because the machines don't really seem terribly happy to treat themselves as if they're nothing but machines. There's a sort of a tension, a spiritual tension in that worldview being exhibited by that architecture, I think. Or here's an obscure song. Well, I'm not going to play you, I'll read you some of the lyrics though. Stuart John Woolley Wolstenholme went to the Bodyworks exhibition, where they have these cadavers preserved with the injected sort of plastic moulding, and they have people donated their bodies to science and so on, and it's meant to inform the public about anatomy and the human being and so on. But this artist went round this Bodyworks exhibition and was sort of looking at the bodies of dead people and thinking, is that all we are? Isn't there more to being a human than just blood and bones? And he wrote this song called Blood and Bones. You know, sitting, standing on the Bridge of Sighs and looking down, the water's out. We've had our run. There is no doubt. We're all washed up with the tide. Still standing on the Bridge of Sighs, our cash is blown. It's all been spent. In every way, we own the rent. We're all washed up with the tide. Seems to me there's more to this than meets the eye. Something more than just the life we're living. Without a soul, we're nothing more than blood and bones. Hanging from the Bridge of Sighs, the whole thing's gone and can't be had. From Don't Look Now, that something bad is all washed out with the tide. Requiem eternum, requiem, requiem. And he sort of writes this secular and yet borrowing the religious language of the requiem for the dead, of the death of the old pre-modern view of humanity, that we're beings with immortal souls and all this, that we're more than just the physics and the biology. And yet, that again, that sense of, but we've got to sort of grow up and live with it and face the truth. But there is in that something of an appeal to value, a spiritual commitment to truth and rationality and so on that we can affirm. But you see that this spirituality is pulling him apart. And then one day, some people at least look into the postmodern worldview mirror and asked who was the fairest of them all. And the postmodern mirror said, although words only mean whatever they mean to you, I'd say that if I can get my colleagues to let me get away with saying that I'm the fairest of them all, then I'm the fairest of them all. After all, values are merely subjective concepts programmed into the human animal by the blind watchmaker of evolution, which only cares about what works, which doesn't care about truth any more than it cares about goodness or beauty. Why should we care about truth? We must keep faith with Darwin and admit we know that all we can know is the subjective meaning of our own words. And I'm quoting from a whole bunch of postmodernists there. And again, you might be able to spot some of the sort of internal inconsistencies in what's being said there. But in a sense, the postmodernists are saying to the modernists, you've got rid of the supernatural stuff. You've got rid of God and the soul and the transcendental values of goodness and so on, but you want to keep this commitment to truth knowable through science and rationality, and the importance, the value of a commitment to truth and rationality. But don't your own views actually undermine not only belief in God and soul and goodness, but also this commitment to truth and rationality and being able to know reality as it is outside of ourselves? And then the postmodernist says, and since that's the case, what we should do is go further. Well, let's walk out further into the swamp. Let's just, you know, let's go the whole way. Why don't we just drown the whole thing and give up on truth and rationality as well? There's another way of dealing with the issue, which is to go back the way you've come, of course. Japanese building, called the M2 building. What strikes you about this building?
It has a very Greco-Roman looking pillar design in the middle.
Yeah. What's the pillar doing?
In its giant form.
Just, yeah. Just a giant pillar. What's the pillar doing?
Nothing.
Nothing. What's the point of it? Yeah. So it's not actually an architectural element that's holding something up. It's just like, hey, let's have a giant classical pillar. Because we can sort of borrow that from that context, and that's fun, and we'll plump it together with other architectural elements from other styles and go, oh, that looks interesting, that's fun. That's sort of typical postmodern architecture, and, you know, nothing wrong, nothing against architecture being fun, but it also says something about worldview. Here's a classic story from Ravi Zacharias, talking about this postmodern building, the Rexner Center for the Performing Arts in America. And again, you can see there's like aspects of kind of like medieval castle architecture being played with here. Only you've got the tower, but the tower's kind of been chopped in half and a window put in the middle of it. So that architectural form's not serving its original architectural function. And so on. They've just borrowed those forms and put them together with modern materials and so on. This is an insightful, fascinating story. Quote from Ravi Zacharias. It says, postmodernism tells us that there's no such thing as truth, capital T, no such thing as meaning, no such thing as certainty. I remember lecturing at Ohio State University. I was minutes away from beginning my lecture, and my host was driving me past a new building called the Rexner Center for the Performing Arts. And he said, this is America's first postmodernist building. I was startled for a moment, and I said, what is a postmodernist building? He said, well, the architect said that he designed this building with no design in mind. When the architect was asked why, he said, well, if life itself is capricious, why should our buildings have any design and any meaning? So he has pillars that have no purpose. He has stairways that go nowhere. He has a senseless building built and somebody's paid for it. I said, so his argument was that if life has no purpose and design, why should the building have any design? He said, that's correct. And I said, did he do the same with the foundation? All of a sudden there was silence. You see, you and I can fool with the infrastructure as much as we like, but we dare not fool with the foundation because it will call our bluff in a hurry. So, a bit more modern art. This is Damien Hirst. This piece is called Hydra and Carly, from the 2017 exhibition Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable. So you can see here, there's a video showing. This video shows the divers underwater coming across and recovering this massive bronze statue of the Hydra, which you may know is from Greek mythology. Hercules fights the Hydra, cuts off the head to grow, has to burn the heads so they don't grow. Carly, Carly from which mythology Carly's from? Indian mythology. Carly fighting the Hydra on the seabed here, from the wreck of the unbelievable. And here it is, having been recovered from the seabed, all of the barnacles and things growing on it. And they have at the back of the exhibition there a mock-up of what the original must have looked at, you know, the clean when it was originally cast. Of course, all of this is modern art. This is not an architectural archaeological discovery or anything of the kind. Damien Hirst had these statues made and then sank them in the sea until they were covered with barnacles, and then filmed the divers recovering them and put them all in this exhibition, of treasures from the wreck of the unbelievable. And this is one of the parts of that exhibition. So again, you see he's mixing elements from completely disparate mythologies and just putting them together, because that's fun. Because we're not telling an underlying unified story. We're not interested in the mythology of a culture or something. We're just playing around with the idea of mythology, of a worldview, of a story. And we're playing around with our notions of, you know, what's true. It's sort of being presented as an archaeological discovery, and here's the what you might see in a museum and so on. But it's, of course, it's made up. It's fake archaeology. It's fake news. Although it's being presented as art, so you know it's fake, kind of. So it's playing around with notions of reliability and so on. Or this should make you feel a little disorientated. Peter Koglin's next. Yeah, imagine trying to walk through this exhibition. It's like
one of those mirror rooms.
Yeah.
I hate them. I just walk into them.
But you see what the artist is kind of communicating through that art. Something about the instability, the unreliability of perception, of our knowledge of reality, of like being disorientated by life. This art is coming from a spirituality that it communicates, whether deliberately or not. So Doug Groothouse, postmodernism is often presented as a radical departure from modernism, because they're fighting, you know, modernists and postmodernists sort of at war with each other. He says it's easy to miss the insight that postmodernism is in many ways modernism gone to seed. It's modernism carried to its logical conclusion and inevitable demise. And I think key figure here, saying earlier, is Friedrich Nietzsche with his wonderful handlebar moustache. Nietzsche is fascinating, difficult to read, difficult to say sometimes whether he's warning or promoting the views that we read in him. But fascinating quotes from this 19th century philosopher that really resonate still with today's world. In a sense, you kind of saw postmodernism coming, I think. This is nihilism, this denial of values. Nihilism represents the ultimate logical conclusion of our great values and ideals. When one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. He wrote a book criticizing English philosophers who'd given up on Christianity but still wanted to retain a belief in goodness and put it on a secular footing, and he said you can't do that. The gay science, i.e. the joyful science, languages change. He said, the greatest recent event, that God is dead, this is his most famous phrase, God is dead, that the belief in the Christian God has become unbelievable, is already beginning to cast its first shadows over Europe. For the few, at least, whose eyes, the suspicion in whose eyes is strong and subtle enough for the spectacle, some sun seems to have set, some ancient and profound trust has been turned to doubt. There's a great one sentence summary of postmodernism. Trust has been turned to doubt. How much must collapse now that this faith has been undermined, because it was built on this faith, for example, the whole of our European morality. It was Nietzsche who said, why should we pay attention to truth? What is the truth? A movable host of metaphors. We can't get outside of our own language. Truths are illusions that we've forgotten are illusions. Metaphors that have become worn out. This sort of postmodernist session with language, and, you know, our language doesn't allow us to know reality. It gets in the way of us knowing reality. The Parable of the Madman is the most famous passage from Thus Spake Zarathustra. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, I seek God, I seek God! As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. Whither is God? He cried. I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually? Backwards? Sideways? Forward? In all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? Gods too decompose. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? So that leads me to kind of grouping some categories of sort of three kinds of experience or question that we can engage in with people, and not necessarily directly about the logos element of apologetics, but are of course tied to it. And the way this opens up thinking about the way in which we can ask questions, but we can invite people into experiences through the arts about the implications of atheism, of materialism, of scientism, of postmodernism, and so on. How those implications perhaps contradict really deep, innate human needs and desires. That from our point of view, we are creatures designed for a world that does have meaning and purpose and value and knowable truth. And knowable truth outside of science, and knowable value and beauty and so on, and direction and all of those things that Nietzsche is saying depend on God, and we have to deny now that we've got rid of God. So experiences that through art people will intuitively experience value that they may consciously, rationally deny. Because it's one thing to say there's no such, you know, beauty's not real. It's another thing to look at a painting by Makoto Fujimura and say that's not a beautiful painting. And so on. So through the arts, through film, through architecture, through music, through painting, through whatever, we can engage people's pathos as a way of getting into these issues about how their non-Christian spiritualities are disintegrative, how that is reflected in culture. How that may, at least in Pascalian terms, make them long that the pre-modern Christian view were true, as a preamble to showing them that it is true. Affirming what we can, but using those leave those affirmations of when they are recognizing the true and the good and the beautiful and so on, to lever them away from disintegrative non-Christian culture, spirituality, and towards a more wholesome integrative Christ-centered spirituality. So then apologetics includes, but doesn't just include, this aspect of, hey, let's look at some arguments for God and the historicity of the Gospels and so on. All, you know, great important stuff I've spent time doing. But also, I try and spend time doing in terms of how do we engage people's heads and hearts? How can we use those together in a way that's reflective of the unity of the Christian view of these things, reflective of their rootedness in God, to point people to God and so on, rather than having these sort of false bifurcations that we were talking about earlier between things. Yeah. Questions, reflections.
What are your other questions? Anything that you want to ask now, or are we?
Three more thinking.
Yeah.
That's good. That's great. I know I've poured several pints into the quart pot, but hopefully some of that will grab you, and as I say, I'll pass on the PDFs and so on.
Well, Peter, genuinely, thank you so much for what you have brought for us today, and just again for that real depth that you've gone into with that. That's just fantastic.